Yeah, and guess what? I'm stationed up here on the moon.
The moon? She cried. That's ridiculous, Milo. Don't you lie to your mother.
She raised a giant TV remote.
I need your help with this blasted TV. The same nonsense is on every channel.
I glanced over and saw Milo raise his QCOM's camera, then tilt it to give her a quick look at the Thunderdome and at the dazzling field of stars projected on its dome ceiling. She gasped, and Milo grinned, lowering the QCOM's camera and aiming it back at his own face.
Told ya, he said.
His mother started to wail in fear. There was no other word for it.
They put you in charge of defending us? Now I know we're doomed.
Ma, please,
Milo said, sounding more and more like a little boy with each word.
Relax. I'm going to stop these things, I promise. Don't worry. I'll do whatever it takes to keep you and little Kilgore from getting hurt. You're going to be proud of me when this is all done. You wait and see.
I didn't get to find out who or what Kilgore was because my father walked over and closed Milo's pod canopy for him. Then he walked back over and watched nervously as I raised his QCOM and placed the video call to my mother. A second later, my mother's drawn and worried face appeared on the QCOM's display. She was at work, of course, standing in one of the hospital's rooms, clustered in front of a TV with a dozen other nurses. Even now, after the announcement, she still hadn't abandoned the people she cared for.
Zach!
My mother shouted the moment she saw my face. She rushed out into the empty hospital corridor, holding her phone up in front of her.
Thank God you're okay, honey. You are okay, aren't you?
I'm fine, Mom, I said. You know, aside from the impending alien invasion.
Can you believe it? She said. It's all over the news, every channel.
She held the phone directly in front of her face. Where are you? I want you to get home, Zachary, right this minute. I can't, Mom, I said. The Earth Defense Alliance needs me.
What are you talking about?
She said, sounding increasingly hysterical. I enlisted, I told her. In the Earth Defense Alliance, this morning. They made me a flight officer, see? I set the phone down on the console in front of me, then stepped back so she could see my uniform. The sight appeared to leave her speechless.
Honey, where are you? She finally managed to ask.
I'm on the moon, I said, panning the QCOM's camera around the room and then up at the dome above. Moonbase Alpha. It's a secret base on the far side. I'm going to help fight off the invasion from up here. I gave her a smile. All those years I spent playing video games weren't wasted after all, eh? She broke down into tears then, but she still managed to sound incredibly pissed off.
Zachary Ulysses Lightman,
she shouted, making the phone tremble fiercely in her hands.
You are not fighting any goddamn aliens. You come home right this minute.
Mom, it's going to be okay, I said as soothingly as I could. I'm not alone up here, okay? That's the other thing I have to tell you. It's going to be a shock, so brace yourself. I pulled my father in front of the QCOM's camera, then stood just behind him. His legs were shaking so badly I worried he might collapse.
Oh, my God,
my mother said, covering her mouth.
Xavier? Is that you?
Hello, Pam, he said, his voice shaking.
It's really good to see you. It can't be you,
I heard my mother say.
It can't be!
It's really him, Mom, I said. He's a general in the Earth Defense Alliance, a war hero. I smiled at him. He's been awarded 3 medals of honor, haven't you? He didn't say anything. He just stared at her like a deer in the headlights.
Xavier, she said. It's really you?
It's really, it's really me, he said, his voice breaking after each word. I'm alive. I'm so sorry. I can't tell you how much I've missed you. And how sorry I am for leaving you to raise our son all on your own. I'm sorry for a lot of other things too, but she started crying again. My father's face contorted in pain, and that was when I turned and walked away, well out of earshot, to let them talk in private, and to avoid a crying jag of my own. I glanced around the room and saw Shin talking quietly with Milo. Nearby, Graham and Debbie were doing the same thing. Wodey and Chen were both squeezed into Chen's pod, seizing their last chance to make out. I climbed into my own control pod and lowered the canopy. Then I took out my QCOM and closed my eyes, thinking about what I was going to say to Lex. I tapped her name on my very short contact list, and her face appeared on my display so quickly that it startled me. Her name, rank, and current location appeared in the bottom right-hand corner of my display. According to the readout, she'd already somehow managed to get herself promoted to captain, and she was still located at Sapphire Station, the EDA operations stronghold near Billings, Montana. She was sitting inside a darkened control pod similar to mine, except that hers appeared to be designed specifically to control Sentinels, Titan Warmechs, and Aethids, and included a pair of power gauntlets that let her control the drone's massive hands with her own.
Hey, you!
I was hoping I'd get to see your face again before the world ended. I considered putting it off until the weekend. I didn't want to seem too eager. No, of course not, she smirked. So, what's it like up on the moon, Lieutenant? Are we being honest? Why not, she said. We probably won't live to regret anything we say. It's pretty terrifying up here, actually. How are things down there? Equally insane, she said. But civilization hasn't descended into total chaos yet. People seem to be holding it together. If the news is to be believed, it seems like the whole world is ready to fight back. It's kind of amazing. It was hard to hear so much hope in her voice and not be able to tell her about the second icebreaker or my father's theory. I desperately wanted to hear what she thought, but there was no time. You ready to give these aliens what for, Lieutenant? She asked. As ready as I'll ever be, Lieutenant. Excuse me, Captain Larkin. I gave her another salute. Then, like a goofball, I pretended to poke myself in the eye as I did, just to hear the sound of her laugh. How'd you get promoted so fast? I asked. For heroism in the Battle of Crystal Palace, she said. And I had the high score on the ground as far as enemy drones downed. Plus, I didn't blow up half the installation. Yeah, they frown on that. Here, I'm sending you a present, she said, tapping at her QCOM display with both thumbs. A playlist of my favorite Terra Firma battle tunes. I like to rock out when I'm knocking clocks out, she said. Helps with my aim. Yeah, I said, smiling. Mine too. A file transfer complete message popped up on my QCOM a split second later. She'd somehow bypassed the security software, so it didn't even ask me for permission before it transferred the songs onto my device. The music player opened, displaying her playlist, which, at first glance, appeared to be a mix of songs by only Joan Jett, Hart, and Pat Benatar. This should come in handy, I said, grinning. Gracias. De nada. I asked her to show me how to do the file transfer trick myself. When she was done, I managed to successfully send her a copy of my father's Raid the Arcade mix. She scrolled through the track list for a few seconds, smiling and nodding. Hey, want to hear some good news? She asked. Yes, please, I said, more than I probably ever have in my life. I think I'm going to be assigned to help defend Moonbase Alpha from down here, she said. You know, provided they don't attack Earth first. We've been running NBA defense sims nonstop since I arrived. I smiled, something I wouldn't have thought possible a few seconds earlier. So you're going to have my back, eh? She nodded. Just give me the QCOM ID number on your drone controller station, she said. I figured out a hack that will allow me to use it to pinpoint your location and tell me which drone you're operating during combat. When did you have time to do that? I've been sitting here all day exploring the QCOM network between training sims, she said. The EDA set it up a lot like a traditional computer network, which made it really easy to figure out and use. That's probably why they did it that way. So, what's your cue, Clid?
My what?
Your quantum communicator link identification number? I stared at the icons that ringed the edge of my display screen and shrugged. I have no idea. She grinned at me and rolled her eyes. See that gear icon at the top right of your display? Those are your drone controller station settings. Right, I said, tapping it with my finger. I knew that. She helped me navigate through menu screens until I located the 12-digit long numeric code she needed and read it off to her. Got it, she said as her fingers danced across one of the touch screens in front of her. Now I can keep an eye on you. I feel much better now, I said. And I did, too. You should, she said. I've got the skills to pay the bills. She winked at me, all smooth like a movie star. And I'm going to make sure you keep all of your pieces in one piece, she said. Until I get a piece. Get me, soldier? Yes, ma'am, I said. I believe I do. Then I saluted, and it made her laugh. But a few seconds in, it somehow turned into a strangled sob.
Fuck. I'm scared, Zach, she said.
She bit her lower lip to stop it from trembling, I think. I'm scared, too, I said, suddenly unable to meet her eyes, even through a screen. My whole life, I always imagined fighting off an alien invasion would be some epic adventure, that it would be like the movies. Humanity would triumph in the end. Invasion of the Body Snatchers, she said. The pod people always win. That's the smart way to invade, not this Independence Day Pacific Rim job crap. Her words brought me back to my conversation with my father, and the doubt he'd managed to instill in me during the course of it. Was he right? Would the icebreaker save humanity, or only seal our doom? I don't want to die for nothing, Zach, Lex said, looking determined now. Do you think there's a chance we can stop them? All of them? That humans can survive this? I nodded my head way too enthusiastically. Yes, I answered, way too quickly. We have to. I stopped my head from nodding. Do or do not. There is no try and all that stuff. She laughed and gave me a smile. I'm really glad we met, Zach, she said. She was twisting her fingers into knots in her lap. I just wish... Me too, Lex. She took a deep breath. I must not fear, she recited. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I laughed and picked up the quote where she left off. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past, I will turn the inner eye to see its path, she continued. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. She exhaled slowly. Then we shared a smile. If the world doesn't end tonight and we're both still alive tomorrow, then I'm taking you out on a date, she said. Deal? Deal. 0 hours, 14 minutes, 49 seconds remaining. My father finished his preparations at the command center and climbed down into his own drone controller pod, which was adjacent to mine. Then the eight of us sat there, each alone in our stations, watching the last 15 minutes elapse on the countdown clock. The general still looked as if he was trying to recover from the emotional strain of speaking with my mom. I didn't want to ask him what he and my mother had talked about, but I still wanted to say something to him, to try to make peace while there was still time. I climbed out of my pod and grabbed my EDA backpack, which was resting nearby on the floor. My father's old jacket was still stuffed inside, and I pulled it out and handed it to him. When my father saw the jacket, he grinned wide and spent a minute looking over each and every patch. When he was finished, he leaned over and hugged me. "Thank you," he said. "But how is it possible that you have this with you?" I was wearing it this morning when they came to recruit me. He laughed. Seriously? I nodded. He flipped the jacket around and put it on. Still fits, he said, admiring the patches running down each of its sleeves. I used to wear this when I would hit the local arcades.
I thought it brought me good luck, he laughed. I also thought it made me look like a badass, he shook his head. Your old man was kind of a dork. He took the jacket off and tried to hand it back to me. I bet it looks a lot better on you, he said. Let me see. I shook my head. No way. You earned all those patches. You should wear it. He nodded and slipped it back on. Thank you, Zach. Don't mention it. By the time I walked back over to my own pod, there were only 5 minutes remaining on the clock. And then 4 minutes. Then 3, 2, 1. I dropped down into my pilot seat and the pod's canopy slid closed above me. All things are ready, if our minds be so, I heard Wody whisper over the comm. Just then my QCOM made its wireless link to the pod's surround sound system, and the next track on my Raid the Arcade playlist began to blare out of its speakers, Rock You Like a Hurricane by the Scorpions. I bobbed my head in time with its opening machine gun guitar riff as the last few seconds on the countdown clock ticked away. When it finally hit zero, a klaxon began to wail, and a red alert indicator began to flash on my HUD. My tactical display lit up, informing me that our remote sensors had just detected the first sign of the Europan Vanguard emerging from the asteroid belt out beyond the orbit of Mars. They were really hauling ass. The dreadnought sphere in the lead was already closing in on the red planet, surrounded on all sides by a phalanx of glaives. Here they come! Milo cried over the comlink. They're coming! See them? Yes, Milo, Debbie replied. Our eyes work too. We see them. There's a lot of them, Wody added. An awful lot. The ones we don't stop will be knocking on our front door in a few minutes, so take out as many as you can before they get here, my father ordered over the comlink. Your drone assignments are linked and locked. Pilots, prepare to launch. Wolverines! Milo shouted. Then he let out a long, whooping war cry into his comlink, which somehow mixed in perfectly with the war cry the Scorpions were already blasting into my eardrums. On my display, the distance between Earth and the approaching enemy vanguard continued to shrink rapidly, and I could feel my pulse begin to rise. Stay frosty, everyone, my father said, and may the Force be with you. May the Force be with us, Shin repeated, with no hint of irony in his voice. May the Force be with us, Graham echoed over the comlink. Debbie and Milo each echoed the sentiment, followed by Chen, who said it in Mandarin. Zhuan Li Yu, Ni Tong Zai. The sincerity in Chen's voice finally convinced me to join in. I keyed my mic and carefully repeated after him. Zhuan Li Yu, Ni Tong Zai. Chen laughed and said something else. The somewhat imperfect English translation popped up on my HUD. We are coming here to kick ass and chew bubblegum, and we have no more bubblegum. I laughed out loud, and for several more seconds, I couldn't stop laughing. I'd only just learned the term gallows humor a few months earlier from a book we'd been assigned in American Literature about the Civil War. At the time, it wasn't a type of humor I thought I would ever be in a position to experience. But now, as hearing Chen belt out Roddy Piper's battle cry from They Live in Chinese struck me as one of the funniest things I'd ever heard in my life, I understood the concept perfectly. All drones cleared for launch, the general announced. Let's go get 'em. The eight of us launched our interceptors, joining the steady stream of drones already pouring out of the hangar under the control of pilots located back on Earth. Together, we flew out to meet the alien invaders. 20. Our interceptors met the Europan Vanguard halfway between Earth and the edge of the asteroid belt, just within the orbital path of Mars. On my tactical display, the cascade of dark green triangles that represented the enemy vanguard began to slow its speed as it closed in on our forces, represented by an arrowhead-shaped mass of white triangles racing to meet it. There were a great deal more green triangles than white ones. But with the fearlessness of drone pilots, we continued to charge forward, straight toward our advancing enemy until we were just within visual contact. Then, at my father's order, we all slammed on our brakes and our wing came to a collective drifting stop. "Bad guys at 12 o'clock," my father announced over the comm. "Fangs out. Prepare to engage as soon as we're within range. You can bet they will." A collective reply of "weapons hot" echoed over the comm channel. There they were, an impossibly vast swarm of Glaive fighters, arrayed in a protective grid-like shield around the massive dreadnought sphere gleaming in their midst, the warped reflection of the starfield streaking across its chromed surface as they hurtled toward us. The disruptor had yet to be deployed. It was still concealed inside the armored skin of the dreadnought sphere, along with hundreds of thousands of troop ships carrying millions of ground force drones.
"Well, hello there," I heard my father say over the comm. "This is General Xavier Lightman of the Earth Defense Alliance. Where do you assholes think you're headed?"
After a pause, he added,
"Klaatu Barada Nikto, fellas."
Then, perhaps taking his own stab at some gallows humor, he whistled the five-note message used to communicate with the friendly ETs in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the same tones that bookended each of the Europans' montage transmissions. The only response to my father's whistled entreaty came a few tense heartbeats later, when the spearhead of Glaive fighters leading the vanguard finally came within range of our ships and opened fire on us. The black void around us erupted in a deluge of crisscrossing blue plasma bolts and streaks of red laser fire as ships on both sides broke formation to attack. Our interceptors returned fire, and then ships began exploding above and below me, to port and starboard, aft and stern, lighting up the mirror surface of my interceptor in a horrific light show. A similar cascade of contained atomic explosions began to light up the enemy ranks out in front of me, like tangled chains of Christmas tree lights being switched on, only to short out a second later. I aimed my Rocket 88 right into the torrent of enemy fighters and fanned the trigger on my flight stick to fire off a rapid volley of plasma bolts. The glaives were packed so tightly in front of me that it seemed difficult to miss, and for a few seconds I felt invincible and unstoppable, like I was using the Force. But then I was passing through the cloud of arcing, swooping glaive fighters, evading their laser and plasma fire, which I did reflexively, almost without thinking, and I smiled because everything had become clear once again now that I was finally facing off against my true enemy. The doubt and uncertainty my father had planted in my mind were gone. So was the lead ball of fear in my gut. Now, all that remained was primal territorial rage and the clear sense of purpose that came with it. Kill or be killed. Conquer or be conquered. Survive or go extinct. These were not difficult decisions. In fact, the answers were hardwired into the human brain. The only thing I could think was, now for wrath, now for ruin and a red nightfall. I continued slicing my interceptor through the enemy's ranks at sharp right angles, firing first, then moving and always firing at the shifting pattern of targets, cascading across my HUD, overlaying the folding formations of Glaive fighters in front of my ship, which moved just like they had always moved in our old Armada and Terra Firma missions. I began to slip into the zone, the old familiar rhythm I would sometimes fall into when I played Armada, where everything just seemed to click. With the help of the music in my headphones, I'd locked into the enemy's patterns of movement, their little digital idiosyncrasies that allowed me to anticipate their attacks and evasive maneuvers. I was on fire. I couldn't seem to miss, while at the same time, nothing could seem to hit me. For a few seconds, it felt just like playing Armada back home. Why would real aliens behave exactly like video game simulations of themselves? The question kept trying to worm its way into my thoughts, but I wouldn't let it. I focused on the bliss of battle instead. Our interceptors were getting picked off fast, but the first of our reinforcement drones was already arriving. Each time one of our drones was destroyed, its operator took control of another interceptor inside the reserve hangar at Moonbase Alpha and flew back to rejoin battle as quickly as they could. Thankfully, the trip back to the battlefront was growing shorter every second because the Vanguard was still moving forward, still closing in on Earth. We were losing ships fast. If it hadn't been obvious before, it definitely was now. We were fighting a war of attrition. We weren't going to be able to stop the Vanguard, not by a long shot. The Vanguard was moving too fast, and it was mowing down everything we put in its path. We were only going to make a small dent in their forces before they reached Earth, if that. I took out 7 enemy ships before my first drone got waxed. The handful of minutes it took my second drone to get back in the shit seemed to stretch on for hours. Once I finally reached the enemy's ever-encroaching front line and re-engaged with the Vanguard, I got nailed by an overloading Glaive reactor core on my way in and was blasted to bits once again, this time without scoring a single enemy kill. As my third interceptor rocketed out of the drone hangar, a warning began to flash on my HUD, informing me that the enemy was already closing in on the far side of the moon. A second later, I saw them falling toward me, straight out of the black lunar sky above, thousands upon thousands of them filling the horizon. "The Vanguard is splitting up," my father said over the intercom, "dividing itself in two. It looks like the half containing the disruptor is headed for Earth." "And the other half is headed here," Shin added. I checked my tactical display. They were right. The Vanguard had split itself in two, like an amoeba, creating two torpedo-shaped clusters of roughly equal size. One cluster had the disruptor dodecahedron at its center. The other was closing in on us. On my tactical display, the deluge of green triangles began to rain down on the base like lava erupting from some Olympian volcano anchored in the stars above. "Moonbase Alpha is under attack," my computer helpfully informed me. "Warning!" An ear-splitting klaxon began to wail over the base intercom. "Knock, knock!" Graham shouted over the comm. "Our guests have arrived, and they never seemed this pissed off on any of their previous visits. Check the topside feeds." I flipped off my VR goggles for a moment and tapped a small security camera icon on my QCOM. A dozen thumbnail windows filled its display, each showing a different camera feed from the base. The exterior of the base was crawling with enemy drones, so covered by attackers that it looked like some otherworldly anthill being invaded by a neighboring colony of metal insects. In the background, other drone dispersal dropships continued to make landfall, opening up like metal flowers as they hit the lunar surface, allowing thousands of spider fighters and basilisks to pour out and join the swelling army of alien drones already descending on the base. "Welcome wagon activated," my father announced. The base's automated sentry guns sprang to life and began to unload a steady barrage at the hundreds of Glaive fighters descending on the base like angry hornets. The fighters' first volley of plasma bombs detonated against the base's defense shields. The explosion erupted and crackled across the shield's transparent surface as its energy was deflected back out into space, creating a dazzling light show across the display over our heads, briefly lighting up the darkened Thunderdome. The accompanying transfer of energy shook the entire base and the lunar surface beneath it. As the moonquake, my first, subsided, I had to resist a panicked urge to scramble up out of my control pod and run to safety, wherever the hell that might be. Instead, I gripped my flight stick even more tightly, pulled my newly launched reserve interceptor into a steep climb, and firewalled the throttle, blasting straight upward into the deluge of Glaive fighters descending toward me. Other drones were launching and forming up below me, adding their fire to mine. I took out 5 more enemy fighters, then a 6th and a 7th. My comrades were doing equally well. I heard Debbie mutter, "Easy as can be easy," to herself over the comm. Then, just as I was swinging my crosshairs over my next target, a hail of enemy laser fire finally converged on my drone from several different angles, and it was blasted to smithereens. I cursed and took control of another ship, but before I could even launch it, the enemy ships had reached the surface and blasted their way into the base's drone hangar. When I fired the launch release on my drone, nothing happened because the catapult mechanism had already been blasted in half. As the towers of unused drones around me began to crumble and collapse, my display flashed bright white. At the same moment, I heard a thunderous, booming explosion up on the surface, followed by a shockwave that shook the Thunderdome violently. I opened the canopy of my pod and stuck my head up, then looked around. One at a time, the others emerged, too. "Damn," my father said, far too calmly for my liking. "One of them breached the hangar's defenses and self-destructed. The whole place went up, along with all of our remaining reserve drones." "What are we supposed to do now?" Debbie asked, echoing my own thoughts, though she sounded a lot calmer than I was currently feeling. "The EDA is sending more interceptors up from Earth," Shin told us, "but they're all going after the disruptor. We're probably on our own here now." He and my father exchanged a brief glance before the general turned to address the rest of us. "Everyone get back in your pods, now," my father shouted. "Shin will give each of you control of one of the base's laser sentry turrets. Try to keep as many of them from advancing down here to the op center for as long as you can. Hold them back, okay?" Before he'd even finished speaking, he leaped down into one of the dual Aethid control rigs he'd constructed and powered it on. He slipped his hands into its power gauntlets as the display screens arrayed around him all lit up simultaneously. Another violent tremor shook the Thunderdome as we all scrambled back into our control pods. As I closed the canopy and settled back into my seat, a simplified HUD appeared on my screens, laid over a high-definition video feed from one of the base's sentry turrets, along with a targeting reticle, a rangefinder, and a power meter for its laser cannon. "Keep firing," my father said. "Hold them back as long as you can." I picked off as many drones as I could, but they just kept on coming in a never-ending assault. Within a few minutes, the inevitable happened. A group of drones concentrated their laser fire on the hangar airlock long enough to break through the blast doors to the corridor beyond. The enemy now had free run of the base. "Breach! That's a breach!" Shin shouted over the comm channel. "They're inside the base. I can see them on levels 5 and 6, and they're already making their way down here. Mostly spider fighters. Hundreds, maybe thousands of them." We all remained inside our control pods, each of us now taking control of an Aethid in different locations through the base. I don't know about the others, but I was getting my ass kicked. Each time I took control of a new Aethid, it was torn apart by spider fighters even more quickly than the last. "Okay," my father said. "Abandon stations. We're evacuating right now. Chen, Wody, Zach, do I have to pull you guys up out of there? Because I will. Come on, we're leaving." I scrambled up out of my pod just in time to see my father make good on his promise. He reached down and grabbed Wody around the waist, then lifted her up out of her pod, away from the controls. My father passed her off to Debbie, then turned and prepared to do the same thing to Chen, who complied on his own at the last second, leaping up out of his pod like Superman, then snapping the general a salute as he landed on the deck in front of him. "Sir, yes, sir!" Chen shouted. Shin remained inside his pod. I ran over to check his pod display screens. He was operating a whole squadron of Aethids posted outside the turbo elevator shaft leading down to the Thunderdome. On the security camera feeds, we could see an angry horde of spider fighters in the process of breaking down the armored door that now separated them from our current location. Each time they slammed into it, we could hear the muted, repetitive clanking transmitted through the stone walls around us. When he saw that Shin wasn't leaving, Milo jumped back into his own pod, saying, "Shin and I will hold them off. Then we'll catch up with you." My father opened his mouth to protest, but another explosion shook the base, cutting him off. Graham shouted both their names over his shoulder and headed for the exit. "You're already wasting seconds, General," Shin said. "Milo and I can hold them off a lot longer than the automated sentry systems, but if you don't leave now, you'll never make it." "Go ahead, sir," Milo shouted over his own comm. "We got this!" While he deliberated with my father, Shin was dragging the fingers of both of his hands across the screens in front of him, highlighting groups of drones and assigning them to attack certain enemies or defend certain sections of the base. I could see him struggling to effectively manage the base's dwindling defensive resources, all while he was simultaneously controlling half a dozen Aethids, fighting alongside other infantry drones controlled by operators back on Earth who weren't nearly as skilled or lethal. Shin glanced over at Graham, then back at my father. Something unspoken passed between the three men. Then my father nodded, and his fingers began to dance across the control panels in front of him. "I'm setting all of the unmanned sentry guns to auto-fire," he said. Then he turned and ran toward the exit. "The rest of you, follow me! Now! Hurry!" He tapped the QCOM on his wrist, and a hidden door opened in the curved stone wall opposite the entrance, revealing a narrow staircase. The six of us sprinted down it just as another series of tremors rocked every level of the moon base. The staircase led down to a large, cube-shaped room with a pressurized hatch embedded in its stone floor. There was a rack of visored space helmets mounted on the wall, and my father ordered each of us to put one on before donning one himself. After I put mine on, I felt the helmet retract in size slightly to form an airtight seal around my face just below the chin line. Then a HUD appeared, superimposed on the interior of the visor, with atmospheric readings and a gauge for the small oxygen tanks mounted on its collar. Once Graham made sure everyone had their helmets on properly, my father pressed his palm to the scanner beside the hatch, which hissed open, revealing the interior of a tube-shaped capsule about the size of a VW microbus with 10 passenger seats inside. Through the capsule's porthole-like windows, we could see that it was nestled inside a spherical underground tunnel, like a bullet inside the barrel of a gun. Once we strapped ourselves in, my father smacked the red button mounted on the bulkhead, and the capsule rocketed forward, pressing each of us back into our seats. As our capsule hurtled through the darkened tunnel, we could hear Milo and Shin shouting a mix of insults and words of encouragement at each other over our QCOMs as the two of them continued to hold the spider fighters at bay. "The base is completely overrun," Shin told us over the comm. "Every level. They're concentrating outside the Thunderdome now. They'll break inside any second." "Get out of there," my father shouted back. "We'll send the capsule back for you." "Sorry, boss," he replied, raising his voice over the sound of rending metal and laser fire. "It looks like we're going to have to make our last stand right here." He said something else, but it was drowned out by an explosion. All of the video feeds to the Thunderdome on our QCOMs went dead, but we could still hear audio. "Godspeed, old friends," Shin said a second later, shouting to be heard over the chaos unfolding around him. My father tried to reply, but he couldn't get any words out. He nodded, then I saw his face contort into a mask of pure anguish just before he buried his face in his hands. "Hey, do me a favor too, will you guys?" Milo added. "After we win this war, tell everyone back home in Philly that my last request was to have my old high school named after me, okay? My mom went there too, and I think she'll really like that. You hear me?" I took my father's QCOM and answered for him. "Yeah, Milo," I answered. "Sure thing. We'll take care of it." "Thanks, man," he replied. "Cushmaster High School. I love it." He laughed maniacally again, and I could hear that he was still relentlessly firing his laser turret. "Oh, wait, one other thing. Tell them to erect a bronze statue of me in downtown Philly, just like the one they made for Rocky, but make mine bigger than his, okay?" Before I could reply, another explosion rocked the base, distorting the QCOM's audio channel. This explosion sounded far louder than the previous ones. "Shit, shit, shit, shit," we heard Shin yell. "Here they come, Milo. Brace yourself." "Come get some," I heard Milo shouting, his voice strangely gleeful. I could hear the sound of him rapidly firing his QCOM's wrist laser. "Who wants some? From hell's hot, I stab at thee, assholes! By Grabthar's hammer, you shall—" Milo's voice was drowned out by another series of massive explosions, followed by what sounded like a hailstorm of incoming enemy laser fire, and then by the terrible, hurricane-like howl of the Thunderdome being breached and depressurized as its atmosphere and everything else inside was sucked up and out into the dark vacuum outside on the lunar surface. But the silence that followed was somehow even worse. 21. As the capsule hurtled us through the tunnel, I stared at my QCOM screen in silence, watching video feeds of the final moments of the last battle of Moonbase Alpha. There were still a few scattered aphids duking it out with alien spider fighter drones up on the surface, while a lone sentinel grappled with a basilisk in a fire-scorched crater nearby. A handful of Glaive fighters were still dive-bombing the base, now completely unopposed by EDA forces, hammering it mercilessly until nothing remained. We were watching all of this happen on our tiny QCOM display screens, as if it were some televised event occurring far away when a massive tremor shook our escape capsule. A second later, the roof of the tunnel ahead of us collapsed, and artificial light poured in from above, as if a bank of stadium floodlights had powered on. It was a basilisk, sort of a giant metal praying mantis with enormous scythe-like blades in place of its front legs, along with an extra pair of clawed, telescoping robotic hands and twin plasma cannons standing in for its mandibles. One of its massive metal arms snaked into the tunnel, barely missing us as we passed beneath it, bringing its fist down like a wrecking ball, smashing the length of track our capsule had passed over a split second earlier. A pack of eight-legged spider fighter drones detached from the basilisk and began to skitter toward our capsule as yet more spider fighters poured into the tunnel behind them. The capsule continued to accelerate, moving just fast enough to stay ahead of the giant metal claws as the basilisk struck again and again, tearing into the lunar surface and destroying the tunnel piece by piece just behind us. Another tremor shook the tunnel ahead as the basilisk power leaped to catch up with us. At the same time, its right arm telescoped forward and its clawed hand smashed through the capsule's rear porthole. My father slammed on the brakes as the interior of the capsule depressurized and our helmets switched on automatically to supply us with oxygen. Graham spun around to fire at the flailing basilisk claw with his QCOM laser just before it lashed out and closed its massive metal fingers around him. Before Graham even had time to scream, the alien drone crushed the life out of him right there in front of us. Then it yanked his lifeless body outside through the smashed porthole and hurled it against the tunnel wall like a rag doll. Debbie let out an ear-splitting scream over the comm just as the basilisk reached back toward Wodey. Chen moved to try to block its path while my father fired at it with his QCOM laser. The basilisk's other arm smashed through another porthole behind me, but Wodey yanked me clear of it just in the nick of time. The remaining five of us retreated to the front of the capsule, out of its reach. It flailed its insect-like arms for a few seconds, then suddenly retracted both of them before standing upright, towering over our damaged, depressurized capsule. My father jammed the throttle forward to try and get us moving along the track again, but I could already see he didn't have enough time to get us clear. The basilisk raised one of its massive clawed feet, preparing to crush us. This was it. There was nothing we could do. We were going to die. But then, just as the foot descended, a sentinel tackled the basilisk to the cratered surface. The two drones grappled with each other up there on the surface, beyond the lip of the gaping hole above us in eerie silence. There was a volley of laser and rocket fire between them, a blinding white explosion, and then more silence. A few seconds later, when the smoke cleared and the lunar dust settled, the massive humanoid face of the Earth Defense Alliance Sentinel swung into view, blotting out the black sky. Then, a voice crackled over the comm channel. "Told you I had your back, Lightman," I heard Lex say.
"Thanks, Lex," I stuttered, my voice cracking over the QCOM. "Thank you. You saved our asses. I owe you one."
"You bet you do," she replied. Her sentinel reached out toward our exposed escape capsule with one of its massive hands, and I had a sudden moment of panic. But she used both of her mech's hands to delicately lift our escape pod up out of the rubble, then place us back into the tunnel just beyond the section destroyed by the basilisk. After she set us down, Lex waved goodbye with a massive hand. "Everyone here at Sapphire Station has already been reassigned to drones back on Earth," Lex said over the comm. "I stuck around to see if you guys needed any help, but Shanghai is getting totally hammered. I have to roll." There was a whine of servos as she stood her sentinel perfectly upright. "Good luck!" Her sentinel powered itself down and fell dormant, like a giant metal puppet abandoned by its puppeteer.
"Who is that?" Wodey asked.
"Captain Alexis Larkin of the 30 Dozen," I said. "She's a friend of mine." She nodded. Then I saw her nod at Debbie, who was shuddering and weeping silently, staring through one of the smashed portholes. My gaze followed hers, and only then did I realize that my father had already scrambled out of the capsule and was now outside, cradling Graham's dead body with his helmet's clear faceplate pressed to his friend's cracked and bloodied one. His comm was muted, but through his fogging faceplate, I could see his face contorted in anguish. His mouth was open in a silent wail as he hugged Graham, rocking his lifeless form back and forth, back and forth. That was the only time I ever saw my father cry. I don't know how many seconds passed like that. I do know that I was still trying to muster the courage to yell at my father and tell him we had to get moving when he finally stood up and scrambled back inside the capsule. Then he hit a button on the bulkhead. Armored shutters irised closed over the capsule's smashed portholes, sealing the leaks in the hull. As the cabin repressurized, my father got us moving forward again. Debbie was still weeping silently in her seat. Wodey put an arm around her.
"Oft have I heard that grief softens the mind," the young woman recited, "and makes it fearful and degenerate. Think therefore on revenge, and cease to weep."
Debbie nodded and took a deep breath. Then, in what seemed like the space of a few seconds, I saw her expression transform from grief into pure, unbridled rage. Our escape capsule reached the opposite end of the darkened tunnel a few minutes later, and we pulled into a pressurized arrival dock, and the capsule's doors hissed open. We followed my father to the armored doors of what was clearly an emergency bunker the EDA had constructed in the Icarus crater. I saw my father hold his breath when he placed his palm against the scanner beside the station's armored front entrance. The faceplate beeped and turned green a second later, and the doors to the Icarus bunker slid open, revealing a narrow tunnel beyond. My father ushered us all inside, then punched a button on the wall. The armored doors slammed shut behind us, sealing us safely inside. We found ourselves in a small hangar bay nestled at the Icarus crater's base. Inside it, 8 interceptors stood gleaming under the halogen floodlights. "We have to hurry," my father said. "Everyone take a ship. Quickly now." I hurried down the catwalk to examine the nearest one. These ships weren't like any of the drone interceptors we'd already seen. They had cockpits and were designed to be piloted from inside rather than remotely. "These are AI-89s, my father shouted to us. "Special manned aerospace interceptor prototypes." As he spoke, he was reaching into a large metal tool chest bolted to the wall of the hangar. He took out some sort of pistol-shaped power tool like a motorized ratchet, then ran over to the first interceptor and opened a hatch on the underside of its hull, revealing a mess of wires and circuitry. As he dug around inside, he said, "We didn't have access to this bunker until the invasion began, to prevent us from using them to go AWOL," he smiled. "But the base security protocol failsafes just granted me emergency access." He used the power tool to remove a small, cube-shaped component from the ship's underbelly, tossed it on the floor, and closed up the hatch. Then he ran over to the next interceptor and repeated the process. "What are you doing?" I asked him. "We've got to get the hell out of here." "Don't you think I know that?" he said. "This is important. 60 more seconds." True to his word, a minute later he had pulled the same cube-shaped component out of all 8 ships. I picked one of them up off the floor to examine it. Stenciled on the side of its gray plastic casing was a long serial number followed by some letters. EDA AI-89 TAC Transponder. His task complete, my father ran up the metal gantry platform and over to a darkened command console that lit up at his touch. The fingers of both his hands began to dance across its touch screens as he tapped icons and navigated submenus almost as fast as Commander Data. In seconds, he had powered up all 8 of the AI-89s. Their fusion engines began to hum and then whine, their exhaust ports glowing with orange energy. My father tapped another icon, and 5 of the 8 cockpit canopies slid open. As I ran over to the nearest interceptor, a panel slid open in the aft side of its hull, and a metal stepladder unfolded to the stone floor at my feet with a metallic clang. I heard the same sound 3 more times in rapid succession on either side of me as Debbie, Wodey, and Chien each approached a ship. It was the first time I'd ever been inside a real cockpit of any kind, much less that of an interplanetary spacecraft. But it didn't feel like the first time. The controller setup inside was identical to those in the drone command pods, and those hadn't been all that different from the simple plastic flight stick and throttle rig I'd been using in my bedroom for years. Sitting in our open cockpits, we were now at eye level with my father, who remained behind the command console on the elevated command platform in front of us, so I was able to see the array of display screens in front of him. "When these ships are in flight, each of them is enclosed in a spherical no-inertia field," he said. "So flying these ships from inside won't seem any different than piloting them remotely. Except for one thing, of course. If you get shot down piloting one of these, you won't be able to take control of another drone because you'll be dead." When he saw our reactions to this statement, he showed us their main safety feature. "Don't worry. The cockpit module inside each of these ships is actually a self-contained ejection pod. It's supposed to deploy automatically in the event of a direct hit, like airbags." "Supposed to?" I said. "These ships are all prototypes," he said. "I don't think they got much testing." My father's hands continued to fly across the control panel. From my vantage point in the cockpit, I could see the control screen over his shoulder, and it seemed that he was pulling up the flight plans for the three remaining interceptors, the ones we were about to leave behind. He pulled a wrinkled piece of paper from his pocket, consulted it, and began typing, as if he was punching in a route for the unmanned interceptors, using the paper as a reference. Then he began to access a series of hardware configuration menus I'd never seen before. When my father finished working at the bunker's command console, he powered it off, ran down the metal catwalk, and jumped into the cockpit of his own interceptor, sliding down into the leather pilot seat like a kid sliding down a banister. The canopies of our five cockpits slid closed with a pressurized hiss. Our engines screamed in my ears as they powered up to full readiness. And then, the small hangar itself depressurized, and its armored doors slid open above, revealing a rectangular swath of the starry lunar sky. We blasted out of the crater and rocketed around the moon's opposite side, and the fragile Earth became visible to us once again, hovering in the blackness ahead. Over the comm channel, I heard my father gasp at the sight, one he hadn't seen with his own eyes in an entire lifetime. My lifetime. "There it is," he said softly. "Home sweet home." Man, I really missed it. I'd missed it too, I realized, and I'd been gone less than a day. As our five ships moved into formation and turned homeward toward Earth, I checked my scope and saw that the three unmanned interceptors were heading in the opposite direction, out into space, toward whatever destination my father had programmed into them. I turned my gaze back to Earth and watched it begin to grow in size as we approached, until its blue curve completely filled the view outside of my spacecraft. My father sent a tactical map to the display screens inside our cockpits. "They're dividing their forces in half again," my father said over the comm. "See?" He was right. Half of the Vanguard's remaining forces appeared to be descending on mainland China, while the other half continued to escort the Disruptor, which was heading off in a different direction, along with the alien drones that had survived the assault on Moonbase Alpha. "Command thinks the Disruptor is probably going to make landfall somewhere along the Antarctic Peninsula. They're sending every interceptor they can spare to try and take it down. The rest of our aerospace forces are currently defending Shanghai."
"Shanghai?"
Chen repeated, followed by something in his native tongue. A second later, my QCOM translated. "My family lives just outside the city limits, but my sister is stationed at a drone operations base in the center of downtown. I have to go help her." "No, we have to go after the Disruptor," my father said. "They'll activate it as soon as they reach the surface, and then only manned ships like these will continue to function. All the EDA's drones will fall out of the sky."
"What about the conventional Air Force?" Debbie asked. "Can't they help?"
"They'll try," he said. "But the Disruptor knocks out all wireless and radio communications, too. It alters Earth's magnetic field and plays havoc with GPS satellites, too. Our conventional aircraft will all be flying blind, and they might as well be going up against Godzilla. Conventional fighters won't stand a chance. It's up to us." Just as my father finished his sentence, we received word that the Disruptor had already made landfall, before our ships even reached the edge of Earth's atmosphere. But the Europans didn't activate their ultimate weapon then, even though they could have. For some reason, they waited. They waited until the five of us got there to switch it on. When our tiny squadron of five interceptors reached the disruptor's last known position, just off the Antarctic Peninsula, the battle was kind of hard to miss. The massive black dodecahedron hovered just above the landscape like a floating mountain, spinning like a top as it finally activated its pulsing coupler beam and fired down into the melting ice below. The powerful beam sheared away huge chunks of glacier and sent them plunging into the icy water. The clear blue Arctic sky around the disruptor was a chaotic cloud, packed with thousands upon thousands of enemy fighters locked in fierce aerial combat with an even greater number of interceptor and wasp drones, all swarming and diving to strafe the transparent deflector shield that surrounded the skin of the spinning disruptor in their midst. The disruptor's protective shield was already beginning to pulse and flicker on my HUD, indicating that it would soon fail. Of course, when it did, there was still the escort of Glaive fighters orbiting around it, dogfighting a steady onslaught of gamer-controlled drones. Fusion reactor detonations kept firing off every few seconds like popcorn, further weakening the shield. It flickered and pulsed more rapidly, and I thought the timing of our arrival just might turn out to be perfect. Then the disruptor activated itself. Every one of our thousands of drones froze, and then, in unison, they began to drop out of the sky like pieces of leaden ash. Meanwhile, of course, the thousands of alien fighters kept flying, unaffected. With their operators safely back on Europa and out of the disruptor's range, its field had no effect on them. A few seconds after their links went dead, the EDA drones' emergency failsafes activated, and their autopilots kicked in, attempting to right the drones and land them safely on the nearest patch of ground. Or, in this case, the crumbling ice shelf. Most of the drones I saw got picked off by enemy fire before they could make it to the ground safely, and most of the others crashed into the ocean or the ice and were lost. In a blink, the disruptor had rendered every single drone in the Earth Defense Alliance's entire global arsenal inoperable. I knew the same thing must be happening at the same moment over Shanghai, Karachi, Melbourne, and everywhere else around the world, as the millions of video game-trained civilians who had been waging drone warfare against the alien invaders from their laptops and game consoles just a few seconds earlier now found themselves staring at a quantum link lost error message. Earth's mighty gamer army was out of commission, unable to do anything now but sit and wait for the end. I saw a few other manned interceptors continue to attack the disruptor, along with several squadrons of conventional military fighter aircraft, but they were now vastly outnumbered, in addition to being outgunned, and they were getting massacred. The sky surrounding the disruptor now contained only enemy ships, an unopposed swarm of Glaives and Wyverns. The now dormant Aethids and Sentinels standing on the ice shelf below were being picked off like beer cans by the spider fighters and basilisks marching on them from all sides. Our five interceptors continued to dive into the heart of the enemy's forces as a few other stray manned interceptors formed up just ahead of me on my father's wing, only to get blasted to smithereens a few seconds later, lighting up the sky on either side of him. But my father piloted his ship through the onslaught, untouched, and so did I, miraculously unharmed. I pitched into a barrel roll as I flew through the flaming debris, silently cursing my father. He planted the seeds of doubt in my head, and now I suddenly saw evidence to support his theory everywhere I looked. My father, my friends, and I continued to streak and loop through the chaos, effortlessly blasting enemy fighters out of the sky, one after the other, while laser fire and plasma bolts streaked past us on all sides, just like we used to when we played Armada together. But these were real aliens we were fighting, sentient beings with highly advanced technology intent on destroying us, and we were outnumbered thousands to one. We should have been dead 100 times already. Were humans really just better at war than they were? Or, all this time, had the aliens been throwing the game? A volley of photon bolts nailed my shield, knocking its power down by 2/3 and snapping me out of my reverie. I shook my head to clear it, then accelerated to catch up with my father and the others. We all locked into attack formation, tearing along the ragged edge of the ice shelf, which continued to crumble and collapse into larger and larger pieces, melting rapidly under the intense heat emanating off the spinning dodecahedron above. The disruptor now hung about 100 meters above the ocean's wrinkled surface, like a diamond chandelier suspended from nothing at all. Its escort of Glaive and Wyvern fighters continued to swarm and dive over and around it, circling it like a